And welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org. We're on iTunes at College Radio. And today is Wednesday, February 1st, 2017. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And my guests today are Chris Bojalian and Manjula Martin. As always, the show covers the art and the business of writing. And in the second half, we spend the entire time talking about the business of writing. But first up is Chris Bojalian. He's back with us. He's the author of 19 books, most of which were New York Times bestsellers. His work has been translated into over 30 languages and three times have become movies. His awards include the ANCA Freedom Award for his work educating Americans about the Armenian Genocide and a finalist for the Lambda Literary Award for Transistor Radio, one of my favorites of his, actually. His novel Midwives was the number one New York Times bestseller, a selection of Oprah's Book Club, and a New England Booksellers Association Discovery Pick. He is a fellow of the Vermont Academy of Arts and Sciences, and he's here today to primarily talk about The Sleepwalker, published by Doubleday. Hey, Chris.
Barbara, how are you?
Good. Good to talk to you. And right before we came on, you were saying, and it's like 2013 you were out here. It was that long ago?
Well, the last time that you and I were chatting in person, yes.
Wow.
I had a lovely visit to La Jolla and San Diego for The Sleepwalker on January 12th and 13th this year.
Wow. Well, let's hear about this book. Tell me how it came about.
The Sleepwalker had its origins when I was having lunch with the director of the Sleep Center at the University of Vermont Hospital. I thought I was going to write a book about dreams, that great Freudian abyss, the id, the subconscious. He had just come from a patient who was a sleepwalker, however, and our conversation rather naturally gravitated there. And suddenly, he was regaling me with stories of people who sleep cook, sleep drive, sleep jog, sleep sex, sleep murder, and I was hooked and knew that I wanted my next book to indeed be about parasomnia.
Now, when you had this meeting, were you working on something else and you sort of filed it in your brain somewhere that this would be the next one, or how? What were you doing at the time?
Well, at the time, I was researching dreams.
Mm-hmm.
That was what interested me. But I found sleepwalking dramatically more interesting than dreams, and certainly more of an opportunity to explore family secrets, secrets between lovers, secrets between spouses, secrets between parents and children, all of those surprising things that occur in all of our homes when the shades are drawn and the doors are sensibly shut.
So it seems that most, if not all, of your novels, you've done a bunch of research for each one, and I'm curious if you tend to go with ideas that require research because of the depth it'll give your novel, or because you're going to learn something you didn't know, and you can infuse your novel with that, or how does that go?
That's a lovely question, and I think the answer is both. The reality is that, as John Gardner said, there are two ways to wake a reader from the fictional dream. Clumsiness, bad writing, and inauthenticity, bad research. So certainly as a novelist, the research matters. I have to do my homework. I always know when I have writer's block, it's meant I have not done my homework. But the other thing is that I think, like all of us, I'm curious. And if I'm going to spend a year or 2 years of my life writing a book, I want to be sure that it is both a project that interests me passionately and will hold my interest for a long time and has a growth curve. Learning is interesting. I want to learn new stuff.
Does
of course, I must confess, I forget this stuff pretty darn fast. After I wrote Midwives, I probably could have delivered a breach in a bedroom. Now I don't even remember the stages of labor.
Well, does all the research happen at the beginning? Or is it something that continues on through the book? And how do you know when you've done enough?
I always know I haven't done my homework when I'm staring at the computer screen and nothing's happening. It means I don't know enough. I will usually do maybe 2 or 3 weeks of research into a topic before I start writing, and that's partly just to make sure it is viable. Once I know a subject is viable, then I'm off and running, and I will research as I need to, depending on what scene I'm writing.
Will you read from The Sleepwalker?
I'd be happy to read from The Sleepwalker.
Excellent.
How long would you like me to read from?
Oh, you know, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, something like that.
Okay, I'm going to read a section that isn't a particularly page-turning section, but it is the first, basically, 2 pages of the novel.
Okay.
The book is narrated by Liana Ahlberg. Liana is 38 years old in the year 2017. So normally I would say you need to wildly suspend disbelief, and instead of hearing a balding middle-aged man, you would hear Liana. But the opening of the book is what may or may not be a diary entry. It makes all the sense in the world. You awaken and smell smoke and see that the cat at the foot of your bed is on fire. And so you scoop him up and race to the bathroom and douse him with water in the tub. You reassure him that he'll be fine. He is fine, telling him that everything's okay. You hold him firmly but gently under the faucet because you are worried about his burns. The only thing is, you're not awake. But you're not precisely dreaming either. After all, in the morning, the sheets are wet where the cat slept when you both went back to bed, and there is fur in the tub. There are scratch marks on your arms and the back of your hands because the cat was justifiably resistant to the idea of a shower in the middle of the night. And, of course, the animal was never on fire. Nothing in the house was on fire, and you're a reasonable person. You know that cats and dogs don't spontaneously combust. But in the middle of the night, in the fidelity of that instant, you were saving the cat's life, and that was all that mattered. Or another time, you open your eyes in the charcoal dark and decide that you're hungry. So you stroll to the kitchen and whip up an omelet, tossing atop the whisked eggs in the pan, a little cheddar cheese and a handful of baby aspirin, a mortar and pestle, the ground orange, a cure in the crock of a medieval apothecary, because in the murkiness of the moment, you are craving the sweet and sour tang of orange St. Joseph's. Or you decide to go for a swim in the river, or you are teased by a stirring between your legs, then a craving, and so you reach for the body beside you. And if no one's there, you push off the sheets and climb from your bed. You will search out a stranger who will satisfy it. With any luck, you will wake before you find one, but not always. It is, you are, vampiric. And while it would be easy to use words like insatiable or unquenchable, they would be imprecise. Because the libertine needs of your sleeping soul will be sated. They will, and that's the problem. So begins the book.
Thank you so much. That was Chris Pajalian reading from The Sleepwalker, published by Doubleday. So how did you choose Liana as the narrator of the novel?
My daughter said something really astute when she read a rough draft of Close Your Eyes, Hold Hands. She's a young actor in New York City, and she has read a lot of my books on audio, including Close Your Eyes. When she read the draft of the book, she said to me, "Dad, take this as a compliment because I mean it that way, but I think your sweet spot as a writer is seriously messed up young women." And she was absolutely onto something. That does indeed seem to be, for good or ill, my sweet spot. And so when I was envisioning who this sleepwalker was, I based her a lot on my own mom. And I decided that the narrator should be her daughter, because I really do love writing books about mothers and daughters. But I've also loved the wistfulness of the past tense. You know, books like To Kill a Mockingbird, Expensive People. And so I decided it would be first-person pass narrated by the sleepwalker's daughter, now a grown woman herself, reminiscing about this cataclysmic change in her family one August night when her mother, a sleepwalker, sleptwalked into oblivion.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, finding your sweet spot or knowing what that is. It can be kind of a challenging thing. I mean, you know, most writers have one, it seems.
I think we do. And I think it is important, two things. First of all, to understand what you do well, but also to push that envelope, to try to escape your sweet spot, too. The last thing I ever want to do is write the same book twice. That is actually a goal I think about whenever I'm working. I never want readers to open one of my books and say, oh, been there, done that with him, and feel that I've gotten all formulaic.
Yeah. Well, I found it interesting. Liana works part-time as a magician. The mother disappears. What came first, Annalise's disappearance or the narrator's job?
It began with Annalise's disappearance. Now, my books are often shamelessly autobiographic. Certainly, I understood not necessarily the symbolism, but the irony of a magician whose mother has disappeared. But the fact is, Liana is a magician because I was a teenage magician. All of the gigs that Liana has are based on gigs that I have. All of the tricks that are in her repertoire were tricks that were in my repertoire. And I never used that part of my life, but I think it's really fun. I think magic is terrific. I think I think for purposes of this book, it did add a certain amount of ironic depth to the proceedings.
Yeah, and I had no idea that you were a magician.
No, it's not something I really talk about, but from when I was about 10 years old until I was 16, I was unbelievably passionate about it. And the only reason why I stopped doing kids' birthday parties when I was 17 years old is because my parents moved from Miami, Florida to a suburb of New York City, and all of a sudden, I didn't have that network. I didn't have a younger sibling, for example. There wasn't a church Sunday school. There were no places that I could think of to figure out how to get work. Mm-hmm. And so the business just evaporated when we moved.
Interesting. Well, there you go. At the beginning of every chapter, there's an italicized section, sometimes just a couple of sentences, from, we assume, the mother who has disappeared. At what point in the writing these sections appear?
From the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about a lot of my work is it demands not just from me, but from my readers, a learning curve. That goes all the way back to Midwives, which has Sybil Danforth, a midwife's diary, through Transistor Radio, which has all of the excerpts from National Public Radio's All Things Considered about the transgendered. And one of the reasons why I do that is because it gives me an opportunity to provide important background material on the subject without it being really clunky dialogue. I mean, can you imagine if I had, dialogue in the book along the lines of, did you know, Annalie, that 10% of children sleepwalk? I did know that. And in fact, 4% of adults do too. It would be a nightmare. So the thing about the interstitial pages, so to speak, is they very often begin simply as a way of providing the reader with relevant pedagogical academic information without it being unbelievably clunky inside the text. Now, they always grow beyond that. For example, Sybil Danforth's diaries are critical in the narrative of Midwives, just as these pages in The Sleepwalker, which may or may not be diary entries, turn out to be pivotal in that drama as well. But they begin with a far more prosaic purpose, and that's just background education.
Well, and then, of course, the book ends with one. We're not going to give it away, but I found it so interesting that the reveal comes at the very end. And I was curious if you were always writing to that point.
I love what Aristotle, of course, taught us about endings. The ending must be incredibly surprising and incredibly inevitable. That's a very bad paraphrase. But basically, the perfect ending should leave the spectator or the listener or the reader feeling that, oh my gosh, I never saw that coming, but I can't think of a more perfect right. ending. I never know what my endings are when I embark upon a book. I depend upon my characters to take me by the hand and lead me through the dark of the story. The Sleepwalker was no exception. I had no idea where the book was going through the vast majority of the writing time. All I began with was a premise. A woman with a very rare form of parasomnia sleepwalks into oblivion. That was quite literally all I knew.
So in terms of that, in terms of depending on your characters to lead you through, at what point do they do that? At what point do you feel that they are taking you by the hand and leading you, I don't know, into the center of the book, to the end of the book? I don't know. At what point do they do that?
You know, there's always a very exciting beginning for the first 50 or 100 pages where everything's clicking and the characters have the lead, and it's just magnificent. And then midway through the book, I usually begin to realize that my talent is not commensurate with my vision, and then it is slogging through Vermont mud in March, just trying to get to the end and telling myself I will make it much better in the second draft. And then at some point toward the end, the characters will kick in again. It will all sort of click in a wonderful alchemic sort of way. And I will get a first draft that I can then begin to massage and figure out what's really going on in this book.
Interesting. We have a few minutes left. I wonder if, for those of you out there who have not heard Chris on this show before or maybe are new to his writing, I wonder if you would talk briefly about your early days. You're so successful now as a novelist, but I remember you talking about the beginning and how you tallied up quite a few rejection letters for short stories. Can you talk a little bit about that and then what drove you to novels?
Sure. When you graduate from college, Penguin Random House or Simon & Schuster or Viking doesn't say to you, you look like a young writer of promise. Here's a boatload of money. Go write a book. And so, of course, I had a day job. And my day job was at J. Walter Thompson, an ad agency in New York City, and then another one in Vermont after my wife and I moved here. And between 5 and 7 a.m. in the morning, I would write fiction on Monday and Tuesday nights when I returned home from work. And I was writing short stories, very Scott Fitzgerald-esque short stories, and sending them to The New Yorker and Harper's and the Sewanee Review. And being summarily and consistently rejected, I amassed 250 rejection slips before I sold a single word. I remember rather vividly getting rejection slip number 250 and thinking to myself, huh, plan A? Not working. Time to try plan B. And at the time, Cosmopolitan was publishing a lot of fiction. So my wife and I were living in Brooklyn at the time. I rounded up 6 months' worth of Cosmopolitans, and I read them really carefully to try to understand what constituted a Cosmopolitan short story, and then I wrote one. It's about a female supermodel who lives in a spectacular loft in Lower Manhattan, with her arbitrage trading husband, but their marriage is a little bit dicey. So one weekend, she goes out to their equally cool beach house on Fire Island to see if the marriage can be saved, but instead spends the entire time playing scantily clad beach volleyball. Cosmopolitan bought it. First story I ever sold. And then when it ran, agents started approaching me, asking if I had a novel. And ironically, I didn't, because I always loved The Doorstops, Anna Karenina, Les Miserables, The 40 Days of Moussa Dadah. So I gave up the immediate gratification of writing short stories and hunkered down, and over the next year and a half wrote my first novel.
And that was?
The single worst first novel ever published, bar none. It's called A Killing in the Real World. It was published by St. Martin's. It's now out of print, thank heavens.
What about the short story? Is it anywhere? Anywhere we can read?
Cosmos, that particular short story, Sparks, you can obviously find it in that particular issue of Cosmopolitan. But I don't write a lot of short stories.
Huh.
I wrote a short story this past autumn called The Premonition, which is actually more of a novella, and it's a prequel to The Sleepwalker. So while it's technically a standalone short story, you can download wherever you download your digital shorts. Even that, though it's a short story, in some ways I wrote because I missed Liana and Anna Lee and Paige and all of the characters in The Sleepwalker and wanted to spend some more time with them.
Mm. Oh, Chris. Well, I always love seeing a new novel of yours coming around, and I so thank you for taking the time to be with us today.
Barbara, it's always a pleasure. You are a book goddess, and your questions are absolutely wonderful. Thank you. And just an FYI, I know you're south of Claremont McKenna, but I am speaking at Claremont McKenna on April 20th about the Armenian Genocide.
Oh, excellent. Thank you so much, Chris.
Take care. Bye-bye.
That was Chris Bajalian. His new book is The Sleepwalker, and it is quite a page-turner. I've been reading Chris's novel since, what was the first one I read? Maybe it was Transistor Radio, which remains one of my favorites, and a novel before its time. And I've read most of them, I think. Anyway, enough of that. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we should have Manjula Martin with us, so don't go anywhere.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby. I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. Such a long, long time. Looks like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you, my love, my whole world turns misty blue. Oh,
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at KUCI.org and iTunes at College Radio. This show, along with hundreds of others, will be podcast in the next week or so. And if you want to know the exact moment when it's podcast, go to iTunes and subscribe to Writers on Writing. And when it's podcast, you'll receive a little dealy bob in your inbox for podcasts, and you'll be able to listen from the start or whatever part you want to listen to. And if you are so inclined, leave us a review on iTunes as well. That will raise the show's ratings or make it more visible so that others can more easily find it. And before we bring on our next guest, Manjula Martin, let me say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are not those of the University of California Regents, but those of me and my guests. And that's it. That's the truth. Anyway, our next guest is Manjula Martin. She's the founder and editor of Scratch Magazine, an online periodical that focused on the business of being a writer. Her writing has appeared in the Virginia Quarterly Review, I'm losing my voice, Pacific Standard, The Toast, and other publications. She's managing editor of Zoetrope All Story. Welcome, Manjula.
Hi, thanks. It's great to be here.
Hi, great to have you. Let's start with you talking about Scratch. Just a minute. Scratch, the subtitle is what I'm looking for. Writers, Money, and the Art of Making a Living. Published by Simon & Schuster. Talk about how the book came about.
Yeah, well, Scratch is a collection of essays and interviews with authors about making a living and their relationships with commerce as writers. And the book actually came about, it's been a long process. Back in 2012, I believe, I was a full-time freelance writer, and I was starting to publish online in different periodicals and feeling frustrated with the lack of transparency around money and payment. I had no idea how much money I should be asking for or whether or not publications even paid. And so I started a blog called Who Pays Writers, which still exists, and it's a crowdsourced list of freelance writing rates. So basically, people write into me and tell me how much money they have been paid by different publications, and I post it for them anonymously online. And that really took off. People seem to really want it. And I know a lot of freelancers who still use it today and contribute to it. And around that conversation, you know, people started saying they wanted more stories. They wanted, the numbers were great, but I also want the context behind the numbers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so from there, I developed Scratch Magazine, which was an online magazine, which was all about the topics of writing, work, the relationship between writing and work, the relationship between money and art, how writers make a living. And Scratch was great, but perhaps ironically, it was not financially sustainable. And so I closed that and thought it would be a great way to I thought that a book would be a great way to find a permanent home for some of the amazing interviews that I'd done in the magazine, as well as sort of continue that conversation and ask other prominent writers to contribute. So Scratch became a book.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's a book that speaks to my heart. When I sold my book, Pen on Fire, I was quite outspoken about my advance, and I wrote about it for Writer's Digest, and it seemed like nobody else was talking about money and what they were making. And I've always been curious why writers don't like to talk about their advances or what they're paid for articles or essays or stories. Why do you think that is?
Good question. I guess I should say it is a really taboo topic. That doesn't mean we don't like to talk about it. All the writers I know are kind of whispering about it, but no one is actually sort of coming forth with information, you know? And so that's part of the effort of Scratch, is to bring that conversation sort of more to the surface and make it more of a real dialogue. But I think, you know, I think money and art is a funny thing. Our society doesn't value artists monetarily in the same way that it values other professionals. And that's, you know, always been the case, going back to at least the Greeks. And there's an essay actually in the book about the first Greek poet who asked to be paid by the word and mm-hmm. how people thought he was greedy and crass. And so, you know, I think this is not a new thing, but it's newly urgent because it's hard to make a living and make art in this world that we live in. And so it's not surprising to me that people are afraid to talk about it because there's a lot of fear around, you know, if I tell someone how much my advance was, then will my publisher be mad at me or will someone else think that I'm not as important as I want them to think? And, you know, there's all this, like, ego stuff that goes into a writer's sort of professional image as well. So it's a mix of all those things. And I also think just at the bottom line, everybody has issues about money. It's hard to talk about for everyone. Mm. And we're no different.
Yeah. Well, you know, one early piece in the book talks about writing for free and how that's essentially wrong. But at the same time, writing for free got her a book deal. So what do you think about writers writing for free in the beginning of trying to be published or at any point along the line?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think there's a huge debate around it, and Who Pays Writers helped sort of stoke that debate. I think that each writer is coming from a different set of financial circumstances, and so it's definitely up to people and their own resources, whether or not they choose to write for free. But I will say that, for me, the line is drawn at something that I consider to be, like, work. So if I feel like I am working, I am expecting to be paid for my labor. So that means, you know, maybe I'll write an essay for a friend's website, or maybe I will do something just because I want to and it doesn't feel like labor to me. Mm-hmm. But if it's work, I think people should be getting paid for it. And I do think that there's been an increase in expectation that writers, particularly young writers or folks just starting out, like out of college or MFA programs, work for free. And I think that in other industries, you wouldn't expect that, you know? You wouldn't ask an entry-level office manager to work for free. You wouldn't ask an entry-level engineer to work for free, you know? So while I understand that there are situations in which writers work for free, and I've done it myself, and I probably will continue to do it certain times, I think that we should all be paying attention to whether or not our labor is being exploited and whether or not other people are making money when we're not.
Hmm.
Yeah. And I also think that, like, one thing about that conversation, too, is the idea that it's a choice to write for free or not assumes that someone has that choice. And I think for people who come from economically disadvantaged backgrounds, it's not always a choice. Like, folks can't always afford to work for free. We don't have the time, you know?
Well, I was also curious, and, you know, as I was reading Scratch, and, you know, reading about your background, and I started thinking about, well, whether there's a fundamental difference between writers who started working in high school or before and those who come from families where working part-time wasn't required. Do you think that has any influence on writers later on in terms of how they freelance, how they run their business, how they think about money?
Certainly. I mean, excuse me, I'm also losing my voice. I mean, the essay that I have in the book, which I think I'm going to read a little bit from, is about sort of like my history of day jobs. And while I grew up middle class, I did always work. And I definitely think that has made me a better writer and a hopefully better person in some ways. You know, my point in that essay is that writers sort of often have this illusion that we are separate from the workaday world because we're doing something that's creative and sort of timeless. And while in many ways that's true, I also think that ultimately, like, if you're not a part of the real world, you're not able to really write about real people. Mm. And so that's my opinion. And I think that, yeah, I think there is a difference. I think there's also a really big difference between whether or not a person has to work as a child or not. You know, I didn't have to work when I had my jobs in high school. I did if I wanted to have bus money or, you know, go out with my friends. But my parents supported me. And some people actually have to work, and some people have to support their families. And thinking about how difficult it is to carve out time and resources to make a creative endeavor when you have to be putting all of your energy towards supporting yourself or your family is a really important thing to acknowledge, you know? So I do think there's a difference between writers who work straight out of school and writers who maybe stay in academia their whole lives.
Well,
I don't know that, you know, one is better than the other, but
right. They're
definitely different.
Yeah. Well, I think it is different. The way you think about money has to be different.
I mean, Cheryl Strayed talks about that in her interview in the book, where she talks about, you know, she was very poor before she sold her book, but she describes it as a poverty of choice. Mm-hmm. Because she had a master's degree, and the way she puts it, she says, you know, I could go get a job anytime I wanted to. I just chose not to because I was trying to write my book. And she's very sort of attuned to that because of the fact that she grew up very poor. And she says, you know, like, we weren't, like, artist poor. We were, like, don't have food poor, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I really do think that those childhood experiences and family experiences really impact the way we deal with money throughout our lives.
Well, I'd love to hear you read from scratch. Would you do that?
Sure. Yeah, right. Definitely. So this is from my essay in the book that we were just discussing. It's called The Best Work in Literature, and it starts in the basement. I began as a stock girl at 11 years old. My job was to run up and down the stairs to the basement of my grandmother's upscale houseware store and fetch customer purchases, sets of wine glasses and unassembled wire drawer units, mostly. Every summer weekend of 1987, I carried outgoing boxes up the stairs and newly arrived UPS boxes down. Between laps, I flattened and bundled cardboard, tallied inventory on a clipboard, and filed purchase orders. I worked hard, but nepotism had its privileges. I was paid $5 an hour in cash, under the table, a fortune for a kid, and on par with what the grown-up clerks were making. California minimum wage at the time was $3.35 an hour. Even then, I viewed my summer gig as work I would one day leave behind. When I grew up, I was certain I would become a full-time artist of some sort. I cycled through the dream jobs of ballerina, actor, rock star, and finally writer. While I was working in the basement, I visualized my future artist life. I would have a post-industrial living space with high ceilings in a large city. I'd share it with a cat and a partner, both of whom would adore me but value my independent spirit and leave me alone to work. My work would be popular, yet retain its authenticity. There would be cocktail parties and ceiling-to-floor bookshelves, of course. Above all, I would never have to flatten cardboard boxes again. My family's store was in a grand 1910 sandstone building. It was formerly a bank. The basement was cool and dark. It smelled like damp cement and styrofoam. But to me, it was the shadowy secret headquarters of capital. My grandparents had repurposed the old bank vault as their office. Its original meter-thick door was permanently propped open, like a steel monument to the place's past as a retailer of money. When I delivered my packing slips to the office, I could see an intricate interior system of old locks and gears in the door's cross-section. Prior to working at the store, I'd been enchanted by the mechanics of the cash register, by its percussive flashes of bells, sliding parts, and coins. But in the basement, I realized the sales floor operations were a facade. The real work of business was happening downstairs. The basement was both the physical and fiscal seat of power in the store. This was where the money lived. In the heavy lifting that made those wine glasses shine for the yuppie newlyweds shopping upstairs, and even deeper than that, behind a steel door as thick as I was tall. I wondered then if everything I knew and experienced might have a similar duplicity. Another thing, a working and sweating mechanism beneath the surface. In the business of literature, the people who mind the store, from writers to editors to tumblers, often have other jobs too. For writers and other creators of culture, the day job, a means of income for an artist that is not the production of her art, leaving the definition of art aside for the moment, the day job is viewed as a temporary step on the ladder to artistic success. Many young writers hold the conviction that a day will come when they don't have to do anything but write. When we speak about our work, we mean our writing work. We treat this work with reverence and hold it up as the work that makes us who we are, artists. But beneath the surface of our art is a life largely spent doing other work. Basement shifts, rent gigs, adjunct positions whose earnings shore up our literary work. Day jobs are that mechanism beneath the business of literature. As such, they don't just pay our bills, they're what we do with most of our lives. Is there value to be found in a day job beyond its paycheck? And why are writers so eager to leave work behind?
Thank you so much. That was Manjula Martin reading From Scratch, Writers, Money, and the Art of Making a Living, published by Simon and Schuster. Yes. Why are we so eager to leave the work behind? That's interesting. And earlier you mentioned MFAs, and I'm curious your opinion in terms of, do you think they help writers with identity and making a living and whatever else people go into MFA programs for? I mean, what do you think?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it really depends on who you are and what MFA program you go to and where you're at in your career, you know, when you enter. I do think that MFA programs can be very helpful. They can be very valuable, both for sort of making connections and finishing work and getting your work out there, and also for sort of taking that time that you need as an artist to just create for a couple of years, which is very rare in our world. That said, I think it's sort of crazy that a lot of people can come out of an MFA program and have no idea how the business of publishing actually functions. Mm-hmm. I mean, I talk to people at events I'm doing for Scratch, and they don't even know the basics of how a book deal works or what a pitch is. And I think it's sort of unconscionable that graduate schools are publishing or are graduating students who don't really know anything about the business that they're allegedly going to go into. And part of that, I think, is the transition from MFA programs being more professionally focused. Now they're more professionally focused, whereas previously it was more assumed that you were going to stay in the academy if you had an MFA. Mm-hmm. But the academy is changing and constricting. So I always tell people, like, if you want to get an MFA, that's great. Please try not to go into debt to do it.
Right.
On the other hand, you know, there's a journalist named Sarah Smarsh who has a really beautiful essay in this book, and she focuses mainly on class in America. And she grew up working poor on a farm. And in her essay in this book, she talks about sort of how, you know, for her, getting an MFA, which she did at Columbia, which is very expensive, was her ticket out. And it was her ticket to, like, a different world. And then she was the first person in her family to go to college. And so for her, that debt actually was an investment, and it really did pay off in different ways. So again, I think it really goes to, you know, what your resources are and what your background is and where you're trying to get to.
Yeah. As an editor, are you impressed when you see MFA in the bio of a writer, or is it really the work that you're going to look at and you kind of ignore bios?
I am totally unimpressed. It's the work.
Yeah.
If anything, I kind of cringe a little when I see MFA because I fear that something's going to be, you know, somewhat what they call an MFA story, which tends to be a little bit over-workshopped, you know, oftentimes like really beautiful writing, but something kind of cold about it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Well, yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the business of writing and the business of you selling this book. Did you begin with a book proposal, or how did that go?
I did, yeah. So I was fortunate to meet my agent, whose name is Kate McKean, and she's in New York. I live in California, in San Francisco. So I was fortunate to meet my agent through an acquaintance, when I decided to close Scotch Magazine, I had the idea to do a book, and I sort of called everyone I knew in the industry and was like, what do you think you should do? And one of these people was like, oh, you should talk to this agent. She's super enthusiastic about this topic. So I just got her, was able to get her phone number, and we talked on the phone, and she was like, oh, yeah, I can totally sell that book, write a proposal. So the sort of excruciating process of getting an agent was something that I was very fortunate to kind of skip. And that accelerated the process of the book a lot, too. So I did do a proposal for nonfiction books. It's usually expected that one writes a proposal, which includes, you know, as you know, a complete table of contents, sample chapters, a marketing plan, sort of demonstration of your expertise in the topic, all that sort of thing. About probably, I think this proposal was about 50 pages long. And crucially, because this is an anthology, I really wanted publishers to get a real sense of the types of people who are going to be in it and the types of people who I could sort of get to be in it, so that they understood the prominence of some of the contributors. People like Jonathan Franzen are in it, Cheryl Strayed, Yi-Yun Lee. There's some amazing sort of, you know, top-level writers in it. And so I actually went in with a pretty complete table of contents in the proposal. I talked to people before the proposal and said, I'm writing a proposal for this book. If it gets accepted, will you write an essay for it? And a lot of them said yes or probably, you know. And for most people, we even went so far as to sort of establish a general topic that they would want to address. So I had buy-in from most of the contributors before I tried to sell the book, and I'm convinced that that was 100% the thing that got the book sold.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's great. And yeah. Of course, the topic is so needed, you know, in this writing world. But, you know, I am curious. We have maybe 2 minutes left, and I am curious in creating the book and getting these essays in. Were there any surprises? Was there anything you read by any of the contributors that just really surprised you?
That's a good question. I think the essay I was just speaking about, Sarah Smarsh, her essay surprised me because of that, because of what I was just talking about, which is sort of her talking about how debt was actually a really acceptable risk to her coming from a working class background, whereas coming from a middle class background, I've always been taught, like, avoid debt like the plague. So that really, it didn't surprise me, but it really actually changed my thinking and really opened my mind in an interesting way. I was also surprised by some of the interviews. Yi-Yun Lee is a great author, and in her interview, she was basically like, I don't do marketing, I don't care about marketing, I just write. Mm-hmm. And I actually found that to be very refreshing. Who else? Well, Jennifer Weiner, the author, you know, who's written some very well-selling books, writes this really lovely essay in the book that is, she just dug super deep and went there and talked about, like, a really traumatic childhood experience she had that involved money and how that's really shaped her whole career. And she talks about sort of, you know, how it feels to be commercially successful but not feel like your work is valued in terms of its quality. And I think that was a really brave thing of her to do.
Well, so many great essays in this collection, and I just wish you the best of luck with it. I think it's great and just a topic that so needs to be talked about, and writers, I mean, I wanted to talk to you, and we're out of time, but I wanted to talk to you about writers, especially women who, you know, feel guilty that they're using their time for writing that isn't bringing in money yet. And
It's huge.
Anyway, do you have a 30-second snippet on what do you do about that?
That's like a whole other book, but I think that is something that has come up a lot in the events I've been doing. It's majority women who show up to these events, and women are just like really eager to talk with one another about sort of the gendered ways that we're taught to think about money and how we're taught to like sort of sacrifice ourselves in certain ways, either for family or for work or for a greater good. And so I guess my 30-second snippet is like gender does come into it and gender does matter.
Yeah. I can't remember any guys, you know, worrying about this, being guilty over this. I mean, I'm sure they're out there, but I just I can't think of them right now. I can think of lots of women, though.
Whenever I'm scared to negotiate around money or sort of do anything, you know, can I say ballsy?
Yeah.
Do anything. I always ask myself, like, would I send this email if I were a man? And the answer is always yes, definitely. Would I ask for more money if I were a man? Yes, I wouldn't even think twice about it.
Right.
So I think that's always like an interesting question for a woman to ask oneself is like, if I were a dude, would I feel bad about doing this?
Right. Well, anyway, great to talk
Sorry
with you.
Sorry if I swore.
No, it's great. It's great. Yeah, love your book, and I wish you luck.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. That was Manjula Martin. Her book is Scratch, and definitely worth checking out. Lots of great essays in this green book. Love it. You've been listening to Writers on Writing, and this show will join the others that we podcast on penonfire.com. And as I said earlier, if you go to iTunes and subscribe to Writers on Writing, you will get notice of when this one is podcast. That's all for now. I wish you writers out there more stamina and staying in the chair, and stop worrying about whether you're making money. Stop worrying and write. And we'll see you here next week.